But if you must, please do so quietly.
If you're going to smoke, we ask that you please be away from any buildings. Also, we ask you refrain from smoking e-cigarettes inside the building. If you find it necessary to smoke, please take it outside. Please be respectful as we're guests of the church. And for our first speaker, we have Rob.
Rob, alcoholic.
Rob!
When's are the moments you really kind of eat your words when you tell these guys you'll do whatever it takes? So, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, I had a pretty good youth. My parents were both pharmacists. Little did I know I'd fall in their footsteps and become a street pharmacist. But, you know, I ended up catching a leukemia as a small child, and I am a leukemia survivor, been in remission for over 22 years now. So from 2 to 7, I was in and out of the hospitals and stuff like that. And then after that, you know, my father, he got diagnosed with multiple myeloma. And I was pretty good in school and everything up until the age of 13, my father passed away in my arms, and that was kind of that turning point for me where I didn't really want to hear what anyone had to say. I was going to do this. I was now the man of the house, in my opinion. And so I started getting involved with the wrong people, the wrong crowds and stuff like that. I think it was 13 when I had my first drink. I asked a girl that I was talking to as a young kid, you know, and to come over, and she brought over a Zephyr Hills bottle full of vodka. And not knowing, I downed the whole thing and woke up in the laundry room with my pillow sleeping on top of the dryer. At that point, my mom was like, yeah, he might be drunk, you know, and she let me suffer through it too. She thought lessons I learned the hard way were the right lessons a lot of the time. And then after then, it just became, I was stealing beer out the fridge, you know, hitting liquor bottles, filling them up, you know, watering them down, maybe thinking my parents wouldn't know. And then, so I started getting in a lot of trouble. I started hanging out with the wrong crowd, started, doing a lot of vandalizing as a kid. You know, funny thing is we used to actually record it on video, you know. With the state's attorney, loved to have that stuff, you know what I mean? Boy, the stuff we did as a kid. But, you know, and then so I got into a lot of trouble as a child, and I ended up in the level 10 juvenile facility at 16. And it was just after my 16th birthday, my mom came to visit me, and she never made it home in the car. She got in a car wreck. At that point, I took it all as like this was my fault, you know. And at that point, I was on a full-blown, you know, I was full-blown using. It was, you know, 17, you know, 18. I got out on my 19th birthday, and I was like, I never swore the stuff off. Was never going to get in trouble again. Before I went in, you know, I was doing the ecstasy, all those dry goods and all that stuff. But alcohol was my main problem, you know. Every time I drank alcohol, somehow I either got arrested, Baker acted. I'm a frequent flyer there, you know. And it just became crazy. Life became crazy. And then, being that I never found any solutions, I got out and my willpower wasn't enough. It wasn't long before I was drinking and drugging again. At 19, they released me on my 19th birthday because the juvenile justice lost jurisdiction. That's when things kind of really went kind of hardcore for me. I started drinking every day, drinking heavy every day, every chance I could get. Couldn't live with alcohol, and then I couldn't live without alcohol. It was a My aunt came to me, and she became my rock throughout this whole situation, and asked me to go to a college in Hudson called Word of Life. And I met my ex-wife there at the time, thinking that that was the solution. And I was doing good for a little while, you know, running on my willpower as long as that lasted, until I was pulling the cloak over her eyes. I started, you know, working at a tattoo shop, doing dry goods, drinking all day, to the point where I actually got fired from a tattoo shop that sold drugs. And life was just, you know, out of control very fast, you know. I destroyed that marriage, you know. She was a solid girl, you know. She supported me for long enough. Quick part in there, age 21, I got in a motorcycle accident, actually on Ridge Road, and I lost my leg. Well, then I, you know, was put on certain medications, and I held on to those things for life, you know, between the medications and the alcohol, that was my crutch. And throughout all this, I felt like I deserve this. This is my right. You know, it gave me a reason to excuse my actions, is the way I looked at it a lot of the times. Until my actions wound me back up in jail. You know, like I said, I was, you know, I'd run and gun until I couldn't figure it out anymore, go Baker act myself for a couple days, thinking, oh, that'll change things, and come back out and, you know, on the cab ride home, like, you know what, can you stop over here, you know, and back to the races it would go, you know. I was using until this, you know, in and out of halfway houses. I'm currently in a halfway house, TN24. This is my fourth time in that halfway house. Just so you know, the joke is I'm TN24 times four, you know? So, but throughout all this, I never was completely willing. You know, I had no willingness. I still thought because I had gone to college, I had all this knowledge that I thought that this knowledge that I had was gonna save me. I knew right and wrong, but I couldn't, no matter what, I had to drink. I didn't care how wrong it was. I didn't care how I hurt you, when I hurt you, or wherever I hurt you. And this last time that I left, you know, without thought or provocation, things were good, you know. And I picked up and I took it all the way to the extreme. And I started accepting life was going to be the way it was, to the point where I was homeless on the corner of US 19 and 19, flying a homeless sign all the time. And I was just, you know, to the point where this was normal. This was life. I had told myself, it ain't so bad. This ain't so bad. I was in that lie until actually the pain inside became so great that I cried out for God and threw out a, you know, a foxhole prayer. I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. God, if you care enough, send somebody. And he sent that in form of somebody to help me get back into TN24. And this time I looked at some of the guys in this room and I said, I'll do whatever you take. Whatever you ask to do, I'll do, because I'm just done. And immediately they said, well, let's get the book, you know, and we started reading. And I was taken through the steps. And as a direct result of these steps, my life has been changed. I'm happy, joyous, and free no matter what happens in my life. I have a different outlook on things. I have a different outlook on the way I treat people, interact with people. You know, I can't even put into words the gifts that have been given to me from taking the advice of others and doing the work. Because that's where it's at. You know, the key to me was actually for once doing the work. You know, because I never was willing to do the work before, and I always just sit around going with, you know, when I'm loaded going, well, what happened, you know? Well, point blank is I never did the work, you know? And so now it's funny because, you know, a lot of the things that were eating my lunch every day of my life, you know, and no longer hold any weight over me. You know, I found freedom from those things, and that's from, you know, doing a fourth and fifth step, you know, and really getting into it and honestly doing this and giving it everything I got. You know, someone says you gotta chase this like you chase your alcohol, and that's very, very true. I would do anything it took to get loaded. Well, now I'm doing anything it takes to get sober. And I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you guys.
Thanks, Rob. We'll have Tori come up and read the traditions now.
Hello, I'm Tori and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And Jeff is gonna come up and give out the chips.
My name is Jeff and I am alcoholic. Here in West Pasco, Florida, we got a chip system. Represent various lengths of sobriety. The first chip we offer is a silver chip. Anybody want to surrender? All right, come on up, brother. That's Sarah, Greg, Xavier, and
Johnny.
I'm not as good as Jordan up here. All right, got 30 days, 1 month. All right. That's Chris with 1 month.
Yeah.
2 months. All right. All right. Brittany, Shannon, Dave, Sarah?
Nico.
I always get the last, I can't get the last. Three months? All right. That's Karen and Cody, 3 months. All right, Green for 6 months. That's Jill and Christian, 6 months. Beautiful incandescent purple. 9 months. Come on up here, brother. Jordan, 9 months. Poker chip style gray for a year. Multiples? Susan, 11 years.
Yes.
She hadn't had a drink today, thank God.
Congratulations to everyone who picked up chips. Now for our second speaker, we have Haley from Tampa's Saturday Night Fever.
Alcoholic. If you can't hear me well, just like make signs at me and I'll fix that situation. All right, so thank you to Sean for asking me to speak. I don't know where he is, but thank you, Sean, for asking me to speak. I'm really nervous. Like, I'm super nervous. This is really an interesting situation. I have like a bunch of my clients are here, and then one of my classmates from my graduate program is here. What's up, dudes? So this is great, but I'm gonna be really honest, and it'll be really humbling and good for me as well. So I have two home groups actually in South Tampa. Saturday Night Fever meets on Saturday nights at 7. That's one of my home groups. And then Sunday night, Yana Speakers. Yana is a clubhouse in South Tampa. That's my second home group. I have a lot of different service positions, and I'll tell you that this time around in my sobriety, having a lot of service positions has made a huge difference for me. I'm one of those people, like, sometimes I want to go to meetings now, but like sometimes I really just do not want to go to meetings. But having a service position has on many occasions like forced me to go because people are relying on me. And one of my home groups is a very small home group, and like if two of us don't show up, like the meeting might not go on. So it's like I need that. I really need that, and you'll hear why, because my thinking is real messed up. I'm gonna try really hard not to curse, because that's what I'm supposed to do, but I do usually say the F word a lot. All right, so, and I'll get to my sobriety date, like I'll tell you my sobriety date and all that stuff. I have a sponsor. I sponsor others. I've worked all 12 steps, and my sponsor has a sponsor. All right, so I'll tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. So I was born in 1989. I'm from Florida originally. I've lived in a lot of different states. I've lived in North Carolina, Los Angeles, Nashville. I've lived in Orlando, Miami, Syracuse, New York. I've lived in a lot of different places. A lot of those places were once I turned 18. I did a lot of like what you hear, the geographic cure, thinking that if I went somewhere else that, you know, my problems weren't going to follow me, and I was always where I went. That guy. Yes, yes. No, I'm just glad you're here. I'm just kidding. So. All right. I just love it. Like the shameless, just like whatever it is. Yeah, he smiles. So, that was awesome. So, let's see. I am the youngest of, I have two older brothers. One of them's only 18 months older than me, and then the other one's like 10 years older than me. And then I have a half brother and a half sister that I have not seen since I was like an adolescent. Like I haven't seen them. One of them has schizophrenia, and she's also an addict, and she's like out doing whatever she's gonna do. And it's sad, you know? And then the other one, I think he's doing well. I just haven't been in contact with him. Not personally for any other reason than we just haven't been in contact. So my dad was one of us, self-proclaimed, you know, said it himself, but also it was very clear, his behavior was very clear that he was an alcoholic and an addict. And my mom, I don't know. My mom's just my mom. She might be one of us. She might not. She's dry now. She's been dry for like over a decade. So I really don't know. What I will say is that, and I didn't know this till I got to AA, but like my belief is like I was gonna be an alcoholic no matter what. Like it says in Freedom from Bondage in the back of the big book that like the medical professional might try and tell me that like I'm a product of my childhood and that like my alcoholism is because of the way that I was raised. But like what Alcoholics Anonymous tells me is that I'm a product of the way that I responded and reacted to my childhood. And I truly believe in that. And I always kind of say that when I've spoken, because my life, like there was a lot of like really messed up stuff that happened, but I really think even if that stuff hadn't happened, like I probably would have developed into an alcoholic, because my thinking was always alcoholic in nature. Like I was always self-centered, I was always fearful. I just had really weird and like things that I was anxious about when I was a kid. I used to sleep with a hammer next to my bed. Like, and I'm not kidding, like just real weird stuff. I was really afraid of the dark. I was really afraid of the dark. And like, I mean, to the point where I would sleep with like all the lights on and the TV on. And like when I was in like fourth grade, I would sleep for like 3-4 hours a night and go to school, because I just like was afraid to close my eyes. Like I thought that if I closed my eyes, like something weird was gonna happen. Like something was gonna come out of the closet or something. I had a lot of anxiety. So my dad passed from this disease. Oh, someone in AA is actually texting me. My dad passed from this disease when I was 5. My dad died from this disease. He was in and out of treatment centers. Even actually, he missed my birth because he was in treatment when I was born. And he actually developed into an IV opiate addict. He got out of like, he was like a very successful chef. He was actually like in the Guinness Book of World Records for like cooking 365 different types of soup, 365 days in a row or whatever. So he was very talented, you know, like a lot of us, I know it's weird. A lot of us are like very talented, like very disciplined individuals, but when it comes to substances, like we're powerless, and I certainly identify with that. And I think my dad probably did too. But so he tried to get out of the restaurant business to get away from alcohol. He really never did AA. He would get out of treatment centers and just not like come around and do the deal. And he ended up passing, and he was missing for like 2 weeks. And I just share this because it's kind of like an illustration of the way that my family responded to like feelings and, you know, when bad things happen, we just don't deal with it at all, just pretend it didn't happen. So my dad was like missing for 2 weeks. He finally was found. I remember the police came and like his body was found, and they just told my mom, and like I was playing hide and seek, and I just came in the house, and my mom just looked up at me and she was in tears and she was like, your dad is dead. And we never talked about it after that. Like there was no funeral. I did not know exactly what happened to my dad till I was 21 and I was in AA. And I had brought my mom to a meeting, and it like opened it up for discussion of like what his cause of death was. And I always knew that it was alcohol related, but I just really didn't know for sure. What I will say is like, I was never mad at my dad. Like I never had that anger or resentment that you think I might have. I just always knew he was sick. Like I always knew like there's something off. You know, my mom used to bring me to the liquor store and be like, point out which alcohol he bought today, you know? So it was a very unmanageable household. And, I laugh at really inappropriate stuff. I was exposed to alcohol and like other substances at a really young age, but you know, I was always like the type, like when adults like weren't in the room, I would like try and take a sip of alcohol, of course, all that kind of stuff. What I will say, what I think is like an illustration of like my powerlessness over alcohol and substances is like, after my dad passed away, there was no alcohol allowed in our house, like nothing. Like I never saw my mom drink. I have never to this day seen my mom drunk. One of my older brothers did because he's 10 years older than me, but like I never was around that. We weren't allowed to have alcohol in the house, and like I still went out and sought alcohol because I was just so curious and I was just like dying to change the way that I felt. So my first like real experience being drunk, I was 12. And one of my brothers was throwing a party, and I felt so uncomfortable in my own skin. Like I wanted to be a part of, but I was way too uncomfortable to like mingle and socialize with all these people. And that's what alcohol did for me. It was like a social lubricant. It was, you know, once I drank and I had a buzz, I felt like I was way more friendly. I was cool. I was popular. I was gonna say the things that I was afraid to say before when I was sober. I felt prettier. An eating disorder is part of my story, and I know this is an AA meeting, but I will talk about it a little bit because it's a huge part of my story. You know, I remember I walked around the neighborhood first, and I was like, I need something. Like, something has got to give because a party's about to go down at my house, and I want to be a part of it. So I just came back, and I drank tequila and Rita's Italian Ice, which is really an excellent combination. It tasted absolutely disgusting, but it did the trick. And I remember I went into the bathroom, and I knew, I don't know how I came up with this, but I like tipped my head over and then brought my head back up. And I knew that like if the heat rushed over me, and if I was a little, like my vision was a little dizzy when I did that, then like the drunk was setting in. And that happened. So I was like, yes. So what I want to say is like, when I first started drinking and using drugs, like I liked the way it made me feel, obviously, and it did not immediately make my life unmanageable. Like at first it was like, this is awesome. Like I have discovered something that I've been looking for my whole life, and I didn't know that it was just this thing called alcohol that I've seen all along. And you know, I wasn't off to the races right away in the sense that like I wasn't like a daily drinker, a daily user of substances right away, but my priorities immediately changed. Like literally after the first, and what I will say too is like the first night that I drank, I blacked out, and I had a lot of firsts that night. I did a lot of things that I never said that I would do and never said that I would do at that age. I did other substances that I thought I would never do. And I was like one of those really extreme goody two shoes, like straight A students that was like, I'm gonna do this and I'm never gonna do this. And that like changed immediately. And I felt like I changed as a person, like very quickly once alcohol came into the picture. My priority very quickly became, how am I gonna get alcohol for next weekend? Where are we gonna party? Who's gonna drink with me? How are we gonna get away with it? And I was manipulative from the beginning. I mean, I can't even tell you how much I would manipulate my mom. I would come downstairs with a long sleeve pajamas on after a weekend of throwing a party when she wasn't home, and I would be upstairs and I'd be like, there's shot glasses in the dishwasher. She's gonna know. No one in this family drinks. I gotta get those shot glasses. And I would come downstairs when my mom was in the kitchen about to unload the dishwasher. Let me do that for you. Let me unload the dishwasher. My mom's like, all right, let's. So she's talking to me. I'm sliding the glasses up my sleeves and going back upstairs like that all the time. You know, there would be, you know, liquor bottles left out in the yard from a party that I threw. And it was always like, those neighbors are assholes. Like, I can't believe they left those bottles. Like, they are so inconsiderate. And like, my mom she just bought it, you know? And I don't think it was because she was so naive. I think it was because I was so manipulative. And that is part of my alcoholism. And I struggled with that in sobriety. Like, I can just make it seem like everything's all good all the time. Like, yeah, I'm great. I'm good. You know, life is great, when really I'm like dying inside, you know? That impression management is killer. It's absolutely killer. And that's something that I struggle with. It's gotten better, but I certainly struggled with that. So let's see. So I developed an eating disorder around like 14. I started binging on food and then throwing it up and like over-exercising. And I graduated high school with like a 4.25 GPA. I was on the announcements all the time. I was in pageants. I was in like scholarship pageants and in like show choir, and I was a varsity athlete. So I was I seemed to other people like I had it all together and like things were okay. But my world, probably around age 15, started becoming very small. Like, you know, one of my friends who wasn't one of us started asking me about my drinking. And I remember one day I was like sitting in like my AP biology class, and she's like, why do you drink so much? Like, why when you drink do you like just keep going? And you like bad things always happen when you drink, like why? And I remember just being like I can't even say the words because they're curse words, but I just remember being like, what is wrong with this woman? Like, why is she asking me? In my head, I was like, why would I not drink like that? Because I'm an alcoholic, you know? I was like, why would I not drink to excess? Why, once I start, would I stop? Like, I just didn't understand that. I never drank for the taste. I did not drink, you know, a cocktail at dinner. Like, I drank to get drunk every single time that I drank. From the beginning, from the very first time, you know? I can say I remember maybe a handful of times maybe stopping at a few drinks, but I don't recall that happening very often. I wanted to feel good, and once I felt good, I thought it might go away, so I just kept drinking and drinking and drinking. All right, let's see. So my life became very small. I isolated from my friends because they started questioning my drinking. I drank and drove from the time I was 15. I started like stealing my brother's truck when he was out of town and, you know, driving without a license, drinking and driving. Didn't even think twice, you know, and like I knew logically, like, this is bad, like, this is, I could get in trouble, but it was like, nothing's gonna come in between me and alcohol, like, nothing's gonna come in between me and having a good time. So I graduated from high school. I had full ride scholarship offers, and I really, at that point, around like age 17, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Like, I was, like, my eating disorder was really like running my life and ruining my life. I was having a lot of consequences from that, and the reality was that like they were very intertwined, but I separated. Like, I thought that I separated them. So for me, I was like, my eating disorder is the problem. Drugs, alcohol, like, that's not necessarily the problem. I can control that. I can't control this. That was what I thought, when really I couldn't control any of it. So I really thought that things were going to change. I start the, around age 18, I started setting deadlines for myself. Like, if I'm still drinking at this time, then something has to change. And then it became, if I'm still drinking, then I'm going to kill myself. And then it, and then I would, I remember on my 19th birthday, I was like, if I'm still drinking and I'm still binging and purging, like, I'm going to commit suicide. And then I, it was like the day before my 19th birthday. And then, you know, something, you know, I would, a new deadline would be set. And I was really convinced, you know, like I had all these plans and ideas of like how I was going to control this and how I was going to stop. And, you know, I really tried everything before I came to AA. I went to psychiatrists from a young age. I went to counselors. I signed up for like a camp one time that was like for 10 days straight where I wasn't going to be able to have caffeine, alcohol, like anything. They were like going to like micromanage me, and I actually brought my car with me and I snuck out in the middle of the night and got alcohol and did, you know, like I didn't make it because I didn't understand addiction at that time. So for me, I thought if I can make it 10 days without doing drugs or alcohol, like I'll be okay, I'll be good. You know, I didn't understand that it was more than just being separated from alcohol, that like I was actually the problem and that my thinking is the problem and that the way that I respond to life and what happens to me is my problem. So let's see. So yeah, I graduated. I went to Syracuse University first, and that was like, it was cold. It was cold there. And it was cold and there really wasn't anything going on. There really wasn't anything. I was an athlete. There really wasn't anything to do except for go to the gym a lot, which just was part of my eating disorder, and then get loaded. And that's what I did, and broke a lot of rules. And very quickly was like, Syracuse is definitely the problem. Like, I need to get out of here. So I relocated. I mean, it's just a long tale of relocating quite a bit. So I ended up in Nashville. I ended up in Los Angeles. So I end up in Los Angeles and I discover a substance that helps me drink longer, like I can keep drinking, you know, calorie free, you know. It was definitely one of my faves. And there it was like marijuana, like that's what it just seemed like. It was just as accessible as that. And my life got crazy. I was very young. I mean, it was already crazy, but like it got crazy. I was working at this gym. I was working at this celebrity gym that's like ridiculous amounts of money to go to. So like only very wealthy people can afford to have a membership there. And I was working in this boutique within it and like selling clothing. And I don't know. So one day I tried on a jacket. No, one day I was cold and I put a jacket on and I'm like, you know, I'm just going to wear this jacket until I'm done with my shift. And then I'm going to put, so I wore the jacket home. And the first time I did it was unintentional. So I wear this jacket home and I realized that no one notices. So of course, you know, I actually started stealing when I was like very young. So I realized no one notices. So basically what I started doing was I started stealing clothes, very expensive, like thousands of dollars worth of clothing from this store, and then selling it and making a lot of money that was not mine from that. I also learned that I could embezzle money from these various celebrities that would not notice if I was taking $500 here, $300 there, and I had access to their accounts. All I needed was their first and last names, which was very easy to get because they were famous. Some of them, their names are not the same though, so just so you know. Like, yeah. Yeah, there's like Ty Diggs, that's not his actual name. I thought it was though. So anyways, so I started to do that and it was bad, you know? Like I knew it was really like any day now I knew I was gonna get caught. I was using at work. I had a boss that I was like trading drugs so that he'd let me drink on the job. And he, you know, and like I look back and like it's really sad because I like exploited these two people that own this shop that like really trusted me. Like they put way more trust in me than they should have. But regardless, again, it was a situation where I manipulated them, you know, like I showed up and I had, you know, a pretty face and acted like, you know, I was doing what I was supposed to be doing and I wasn't. So I left. Like, I left Los Angeles. I went back home. I really was going bankrupt. I had sold everything in my apartment except for my mattress. And so I was sleeping on my mattress. And, you know, back home, my family didn't know that. My family thought that, like, my mom had left me with a fully furnished, safe apartment and in West Los Angeles. And, you know, when I decided to come home to Florida, it was because Haley wants to come home and she wants to go to a different college. And that was always my cover. You know, it was always like, well, I got accepted to this college, so I'm going to go here now because I want to change my major. When really it's like I was running from my problems. I was running from myself. I knew I was about to get into trouble. So I left, and it's actually been a while now, but there was a period of time where, like, I couldn't even go back to Los Angeles because if I did, there was a warrant for my arrest because of so many speeding tickets and so many parking tickets that I just never paid when I left. Like, I'm talking like 15 of them. So, you know, like, just unmanageability, just complete unmanageability. And actually, I came home with a bunch of stolen goods, and I gave all these gifts to my family and to my friends. And, like, they really thought, like, Haley, wow, she's doing really well. Like, these sandals are, like, really expensive. And, like, you know, so it is funny now, but like it just, it totally fed my self-hatred, you know what I mean? Like, it totally fed my insecurity and like just that whole thing that we hear about where it's like, if you really knew me, you would not like me, or if you really knew me and knew my behavior and knew what I was really doing and who I really was, like, you would not love me. I carried that with me into every friendship, every relationship, you know, even my relationship with my family, you know, because I knew the truth of what I was doing. You know, it's like, to thine own self be true. That applies in many different ways. And for me, like, I knew my truth when I wasn't acting what was in line with what I believed in, you know? And that's like, that's alcoholism, right? Is like wanting to be a different person than I am and continuing to be a person that I don't want to be, despite the fact that every day I was waking up saying, I'm going to do something different today, and not doing something different. Like, that's one thing I'm super grateful for, is that, powerlessness. An unmanaged, like, powerlessness was never like a very difficult concept for me. I saw so many examples of it in my life, and there were many times when I tried to get sober and did not stay sober. So I knew that, like, this thing is more powerful than I am. So anyways, I did get sober. At one point I went to treatment. I went to a treatment center and I got sober. And I went for my eating disorder initially. I was like, I need to stop binging and purging. This is getting bad. I almost died in October of 2007 from suffocation from my eating disorder. And I remember that night, like, I was Baker active and I was brought to the hospital and everything. And I remember, like, saying, like, I'm never going to do that again. Like, there's no way. Like, I will die if I do that. And I remember, like, immediately as soon as I got out of the hospital, like, the first thing I did was went and got alcohol and drank. And within 2 days, I was back to binging and purging. And, you know, it was really bad and it was really scary. And every time that I did it, I thought, like, I might die. Like, this might be the time that I die. And that, again, like, I needed to be under the influence because I couldn't even deal with my own fear, you know? I couldn't even deal with my own fear. So, anyways, I got sober in AA. I was sober for about 5.5 years, and so this is not the first time that I've been sober. So I was sober for about 5.5 years, and I think it's really important to share about this because my life got good. My life got really good. I had worked the steps. I went to a halfway house after going to this treatment center. I was not completely honest about everything that was going on with me, though. I was really struggling with my eating disorder. And I was too proud after, like, at first I was, like, sharing about it. Like, I was like, yeah, like, I'm 6 months sober and, like, I'm still binging and purging. And, like, I ended up going to a treatment center when I was, like, 6 months sober for my eating disorder. And, you know, and that was very humbling and, like, tough. And then after that, like, I got into a relationship. There goes my bottle cap. Sweet. I got into a relationship and with someone who was sober in AA for about 3 years when I was, like, 90 days sober. And, you know, everyone that cared about me and cared about us as individuals, like, warned us, like, don't do that. Like, like, it's cool that you have 3 years, but she has 90 days. And, you know, I went to this treatment center and, like, the therapists were like, please do not get into a relationship. Like, he's a great person. We know him personally, but, like, don't do this to yourself. And I just didn't listen at all. And what I want to say about that is, like, it seemed like it was going to work out for a long time. It really did. No, it really did. Like, we got engaged. We were, you know, I was, he's still sober to this day. I think he's going to be picking up 9 years soon. I stayed sober for about, you know, like 5.5 years. But the relationship ended because it just was naturally supposed to end. And when that relationship ended, I was like, I don't feel very comfortable in AA because I never took the time to get to know myself as a sober individual because I immediately got into this relationship. And even though I didn't think I made this person my higher power, in a lot of ways I did. So it was, you know, those people were right. Those people that, like, I remember at one point when I was like, we were together for like 4 years, being like, yeah, we showed them, you know, and it, I didn't, you know, because I didn't stay sober. And that's not the only reason. It really had to do with, like, life got good. You know, I graduated with my bachelor's. I started graduate school. Life got really busy with really good things. You know, got a house, and I was really just running the show in a lot of ways, and I wasn't being transparent. Like, I was going to AA, but, like, I was not telling you that, like, I was scared, like, I wasn't really that happy in my relationship, and I don't even know if I want to get married. I wasn't saying any of that stuff. I was very prideful, and so anyways, like, the relationship ended, and I started using drugs. I was a substance abuse counselor and an eating disorder therapist. It actually started where I relapsed in my eating disorder. I was very active in my eating disorder. I was scared to ask for help because I thought I'd lose my job. I'd lose, you know, my school situation all in one bit. So instead of choosing honesty, I chose to be deceitful, and it very quickly turned into, all right, I'm going to try and use substances to make this eating disorder go away. And then it got bad really quick. And what I'll say is, like, I was really dishonest. Like, I spoke at AA meetings when I was getting high. I was very active in AA, like, seemingly active in AA. Like, I showed up to meetings, but again, like, if you would have asked me, how are you doing? It was like, I'm good, thanks. You know, because I was getting high in AA, you know, and no one knew. And I was pretty good at hiding it for a while until my behavior became very erratic, actually at work. And this was actually, I was working at the same treatment center that I was once a client at. So they knew my history. And what happened was, like, I really thought that I was the exception. Like, I thought, like, my main drug of choice is alcohol. So if I use this other substance, like, I'll be good. As long as I don't drink, I'm good. I'm not powerless. And I'm going to be different than, like, most people that get led back to their drug of choice. And that obviously was not the case. What happened was that, and I'm so blessed that I had gained so many relationships in AA prior to relapsing, because it was the people in AA who confronted me. It was probably one of the hardest times of my life. People thought that it was mental health issues. People thought that I'm I was bipolar, and I am bipolar, but they thought that I was active in my bipolar disorder, and that's what my erratic behavior was. My process notes, I was a therapist, my process notes were like this long, which is not, like, they should be like that long. So a lot of my behavior seemed like I was just a very productive person, but really I was getting high. And so anyways, on January 31st of 2015, I was at work. I led a women's process group, and right afterward, my sponsor said, I need you to meet me at Starbucks. I need to talk to you. And I knew that she was about to confront me about a lot of lies. And I remember texting her and being like, I need you to tell me what we're meeting about because I'm anxious and I can't run a process group with this kind of anxiety. And she was like, I don't care. I'll see you at noon. I was like, yeah, I really don't like you right now. And what I want to say is that prior to that, I had written a 12-page suicide note. I had deeply considered ending my own life because of the lies that I had told and because of what I felt like was up against me. I had considered leaving the state of Florida and not getting honest, just leaving the state of Florida. I had considered leaving my job and just going to a different part of Florida. I mean, I was really scared about what was gonna happen. And anyways, I went to Starbucks and my sponsor said, you know, these are some lies that you've been saying and like, I know that they're not true. And immediately I said, oh my gosh, but they are true. Like I tried to lie. And she is a tough broad. And she was like, no, like you're lying. And she actually told me afterward that she was really scared because she thought that I might genuinely just have some really severe mental health issues, that I genuinely was believing my own lies. But I got honest. I broke down. I've never cried more than I cried that day. My eyes were so puffy, I couldn't even see them. Like, it was insane. And in a lot of ways, it was like I did a fourth and a fifth in that moment and in the hour after. I did another one after that, but in a lot of ways that was like that. I actually ended up then calling my supervisor at work with my sponsor and getting honest with her. And then I immediately went and met up with my friend Logan, who was a coworker of mine, and got completely honest with him. So in a lot of ways I did a lot of things that day. It was probably one of the hardest things. Getting sober again was one of the hardest things I ever have to do. And what I want to say is, like, relapse is not a requirement. Like, you do not have to pick up again. Like, I know so many people that are one-chip wonders, and I'm so stubborn, and my own intelligence and my own ego and arrogance completely got in the way. You know, like, I just thought I knew better, and I really thought I knew better. I really thought that I was gonna like beat the system and that I was gonna do like just enough of AA and, you know, get away and reap the benefits of it. And what I know today is when I put anything before AA, I lose anything that I put before it. And I heard that forever, you know? I heard that all, I used to say that to clients, you know? And I experienced that myself, you know? Absolutely, I lost my job that day. I had to postpone my graduate program by 2 semesters, which at the time I didn't even know if I was gonna be able to complete it. So in that moment, I felt like I'd lost my school situation that day. I called my mom on the phone after I talked to all those other people. She knew what was going on because my AA friends had reached out to her, and she was ready to put me in a lockdown facility in another state because she was like, I don't know like if this is substance abuse or like insanity. And I'm like, well, it's both. I mean, it's insane. But it was bad, you know, like I had never experienced just demoralization, you know, like I was humiliated and I felt like I couldn't come back from that. And what I want to say is like, I truly believe you can come back from anything. I really do. Like AA, the people in AA are the most forgiving, beautiful souls I've ever met in my entire life. Like it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And the blessing is that my threshold for judgment of other people today is like so different than it used to be. Like literally, like I didn't even share the exact nature and details of some of the lies that I told and some of the things that I did. But I mean, nothing makes me flinch today, you know, nothing. And like nothing makes me see people any lower than me or lower than another individual, because just the where this disease took me, you know. I'm just really grateful to be sober, and I mean, it's really humble. Like it's super humbling. Like I didn't want to come here and like share like with my clients in the room, you know. I really didn't want to because it's tough, you know. But I'm really glad that I did, because I need that, you know. Like I need the humility. And you know, I'm sober for a day at a time. That's all I have. Like, all I have is today. And I truly believe that God has done for me what I can't do for myself. I'm in a much different place in my life just almost a year later than I was a year ago. And if you would have told me a year ago that, like, You're going to have a job that you like more, and you are going to be graduating in 2 weeks with your master's degree, and your family is actually going to kind of want you around and like think that you're actually, what I want to say about the amends process real quick, I know I have like 1 minute. I went to Texas and made direct amends to two of my brothers. I hadn't seen one of them since 2011, the other one since 2014. Both of our addictions had completely like ravaged our relationship. I made a direct amends to both of them, and it was like the most beautiful experience that I've ever had. This was just in May. One of my brothers said, "I'm so sorry about what happened, but I'm so glad it happened because for the first time in my life, I see you as a human being. You've been Little Miss Perfect your whole life. That's how you've always portrayed yourself, even though deep down I knew that's not who you were. And for the first time, I like you're a human being and I feel like I can relate to you and I feel like we can talk about like real stuff, and I'm so grateful for that." And I have a relationship with one of my brothers today that we literally have exchanged like 5 words a year since I was like 10 years old. Like, that's beautiful, and that's a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you for letting me share.